From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One thing that really gets politicians' attention is redistricting. That's the once every 10 years process of redrawing political maps based on new census data. Although it might seem a bit inside baseball to the average person, redistricting is really important because it helps decide who will win elections over the next 10 years. Often, elected officials draw their own district lines, but critics say that's a conflict of interest, and voters decided to do it differently this time in California. A Citizens Commission was given the job of redrawing political boundaries for state and congressional districts. The commission finalized its maps yesterday. Did the commission do a good job? Are the maps much different from what we might have expected if lawmakers had drawn them? What impact will the new maps have on politics and government over the next decade? And what about the prospects for any legal challenges? Joining us are two experts on redistricting with a political perspective. Paul Mitchell is a Democratic political consultant and head of the firm Redistricting Partners. And Tony Quinn is co-editor of the California Target book, a nonpartisan analysis of legislative and congressional campaigns. He worked for many years in Republican politics and government. Paul, welcome to the show. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, an overview of the work that the Citizens Redistricting Commission did. Paul, on balance, do you think they did a good job or not?
Well, I think the question has to be split. In process, they did an amazing job with the process. This is the most open, transparent redistricting process ever since the birth of democracy. But then when you look at results, there's a different question and different analysis that's going to take more time to really determine the effectiveness of it, in how it creates competitive elections, how it achieves some of the criteria that people were looking at when they voted for Prop 11 and Prop 20.
Okay. Well, Tony, starting with the process, do you agree with Paul that it was open and transparent?
Yes, pretty much. I do think that the major failure in the process was we did not really see the final maps that they voted on until the very end. They had one set of maps. They had a lot of hearings about them, and then they junked those maps. They were supposed to have had a second set so that the public could, give their views on them, and they really never did that. So I think that the process started out very well, but in the end, they probably failed to really inform the public as to what the final maps were going to be.
And why do you think that happened?
They ran out of time. I think they spent too much time in too many hearings. They got to the middle of last month. They decided, I'm not sure this was correct, that they could not make any changes during the final 2 weeks. They knew that they had to certify the final maps on August 15th. That's what the law says. And they got rushed at the end. And they, at least in the Senate map, now they admit that they made some serious mistakes in the end. They actually regressed Latinos in the Senate map, and several of the commissioners yesterday, when they did their certification, said, "Gee, I wish we could have done this over."
Paul, you said that this was a very open and transparent process, but based on what Tony was saying, maybe it was just a little bit too open and transparent, and that sort of bogged things down.
Yeah, it was open and transparent. They did have dozens and dozens of hearings, and they did get bogged down in a lot of community of interest testimony. But that's part of the process that the voters wanted. The voters wanted something that was going to be where the public was going to be engaged. And it was not maybe as transparent as they had tried to make it at the beginning. They did end up having to rush a little bit. But compared to 10 years ago, the maps came out on a Friday and were passed on a Tuesday.
Do you think that that they complied with the will of the voters in the way that they handled this, the commission?
They complied with the language of the law. I think the voters really believed that there was going to be this different set of outcomes. Districts were going to be circles and squares. They weren't going to have squiggly lines. They were going to create competitive elections and moderate the legislature and fix dysfunction. I don't think a lot of that stuff is going to happen because the commission didn't have the tools to do that stuff. But they did follow the language of Prop 11 and 20, and I think they did a good job. There are some outcome concerns that I have, like Tony does, with a few Latino Senate districts that they could have drawn better. Oftentimes when Asians and Latinos were commingled in communities like in Orange County or San Jose, they didn't do a very good job of separating those groups and maximizing the voting potential for those two groups. But that's really getting in the weeds.
My guests are Paul Mitchell, who you just heard, and Tony Quinn. They're experts on redistricting, and we're talking about the statewide, the California and congressional redistricting maps that were finalized yesterday by the Citizens Commission that was given the job to do that. Tony, how do you think they could have handled the map drawing better to avoid the problems that both you and Paul have talked about?
Well, I think that they really failed in one way, and that was with the requirement, which is actually in the law, for geographical compactness. You take a look at what happened with Sacramento County. Here we have the population for a Senate district and a half. We ended up with parts of six Senate districts. We have one that goes from Rancho Cordova to Red Bluff. We have one that goes from Fair Oaks to the Oregon border. We have one that goes from the East County all the way down to Death Valley, and one that goes off to the Napa County wine country. Those are not compact. Those are not areas that have anything in common. I think that a major failure was they should have divided the state into its natural geographic regions, then drawn the districts within those regions. I think you would have found more compact seats and seats that made more sense.
When you say the regions of the state, what do you mean, like the Central Valley?
Yes, actually, in Northern California, if you took the Bay Area and North Coast counties, you have exactly 9 Senate seats, 18 Assembly seats. They should have drawn those as a unit. They should have simply started at the Oregon border and built district in a sequential manner as you went down through the Central Valley.
But they did not do that. But don't you then run the risk of bumping into some other problem? You may have neater looking districts that hold together geographically, but you have problems of communities of interest and so on.
Well, you do have Voting Rights Act problems. The Central Valley has some counties that have to be treated in a special way. And I believe that they could do that. Generally, on the Voting Rights Act, in all of the plans, they did okay. I think they made some errors. But when it came to the other parts of the state, the rural areas, they just didn't care about them. And so you get these willy-nilly districts that run in all directions.
Paul Mitchell, isn't this all a bit like trying to grab hold of a balloon and no matter where you squeeze it, it's going to pop out somewhere else? There are so many rules and requirements that it's maybe impossible to satisfy them all 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is a lot of what Tony's talking about in Sacramento could be attributed to the commission's real focus on keeping San Joaquin whole in a lot of these plans. San Joaquin in the old lines did not have one elected assembly member, senator, or congressman who was from San Joaquin. They were always represented by people in areas where outside of the county, and their voting strength was diluted. Now we have districts that are better for San Joaquin and a lot worse for Sacramento. And one of the things that's interesting when we step back is 6 months ago or a year ago, a lot of people thought that this new redistricting reform would create the geographically compact districts. It would not split as many cities and counties. It would keep communities of interest together. That was the driving force. In the end, the driving force was really the Voting Rights Act and the need to maintain certain baseline Latino, Asian, and then deal with African-American populations in the context of the Voting Rights Act. And that was the biggest issue that the commission faced. And it created a lot of these upstream and downstream effects with districts and some of the crazy splits. There's actually more city splits in this plan than there is in the legislatively drawn plan 10 years ago.
Paul, do you think that if lawmakers had been given the job again this time to do the redistricting, that they would have come up with districts quite different from what the commission did?
They would have come up with different districts. They would have not followed a process that we had the opportunity to see this year.
With public input.
And I think that would have been a loss. They would have leveraged the redistricting to get the budget passed maybe on time and do these other things that were a byproduct of being able to have the legislative control over redistricting. In the end, would they have created seats that were more competitive than the state plan? Would they have kept communities of interest together? You know, that's just conjecture. Nobody knows.
Tony, what do you think would have happened if lawmakers had handled it?
Well, I worked for lawmakers in 1971 and 1981, and the priority was take care of your own seat. you would have had either a partisan gerrymander, which you had in 1981, or which you had in 2001, which was a bipartisan one. You would have had virtually no competitive seats. Staffers for legislators do not draw competitive seats. So the process is better, and I do agree with Paul on that. Overall, we probably have a better plan, at least in the Assembly and in Congress, than the legislature would have drawn. I think the Senate plan turned out to be so bad, I'm not certain that they did much better than the legislature would have done there.
You said, Tony, that when you worked in the legislature, that the priority for lawmakers was to take care of their own seats. Was that stated or just understood for staff?
That was very clearly stated. I mean, I never walked into a legislator's office and said, hey, here's your new marginal seat. Have fun going and running in it. When I walked into a legislator's office, they wanted to know where their finance director lived, where their campaign chairperson lived, where the voters were that they got 95% of the vote in the last in their last race. There is nothing in the legislative process that allows any kind of public input. And that's one of the reasons I was a strong supporter of Prop 11 and Prop 20 to create this process, because I went through the legislative process and I know how it works.
Paul, do you think there's going to be a change in the balance of power in the legislature or in the California congressional delegation based on the maps as you know them at this point?
In the Assembly, I think we're looking at about the same numbers. In the Senate, I think the Democrats are going to be able to get to 2/3. That should be pretty easy. And in Congress, we should pick up 2 or 3 congressional seats for Democrats. And part of this is because the redraw 10 years ago kind of held everything in place. So we're now seeing what is effectively a 20-year correction. And the state has changed a lot in terms of its partisanship, the drop in numbers for the Republican Party, and particularly the shift of Latinos and more liberal voters out to the Inland Empire. So a lot of these factors that have been kind of frozen in time for 20 years in terms of the lines are, you know, coming to bear on these plans.
Well, Tony Quinn, those 2/3 votes in the state legislature are key when it comes to tax votes. So if Paul is right that that the 2/3 vote could be reached by Democrats in the Assembly, that makes the Senate all the more crucial. Not surprising, I guess, that the California Republican Party is concerned.
It's the other way around. I agree with Paul completely. The commission, and I think did it on a partisan basis, gave the Democrats 2/3 in the state Senate.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I misspoke.
But the Assembly numbers, I agree, are probably no change. I think the Republicans will refer the state Senate plan. I think that there's so many problems with it that they'll get some support for doing that. They look at the loss of the two-thirds. This happened on the Central Coast, where you had two marginal Republican districts. One of the commissioners who had strong ties to Democrats in that area and had given money to Democrats in that area saw to it that those districts were drawn to be safe Democratic seats. I think that is the thing that really bothers the Republicans the most, and that is why we're going to see a referendum on the state Senate plan.
What about legal challenges? Do you expect them, and do you think they'll succeed? Paul?
I think there will be some legal challenges, and I think there's some basis for legal challenge by the Latinos, particularly in a San Diego Senate district currently held by Juan Vargas, that should have been considered a Section 2 Voting Rights Act district. They made it less Latino, and that probably violated federal law, and they probably have a good case there. I think there will be a lot of squawking about a referendum. I don't think there will ultimately be a referendum that is successful in getting the signatures, in part because it's so costly. And the second part is that even if you did find $3 million you wanted to spend on collecting signatures, there's no guarantee that you're going to get a plan drawn by the courts that's any better. The plan drawn by the courts could be worse. So what is the justification for putting up this $3 million, initial investment when you don't have much guarantee that you're going to get better lines at the end of the process?
And Tony Quinn, what lessons do you think could be learned from this whole process in California, looking towards the next time redistricting needs to be done?
Well, I think that the state auditor who was in charge of selecting the pool did a very poor job. and the pool did not reflect the state as a whole. I think that should be corrected. Actually, having the auditor do this job was not a good idea.
That was in the initiative.
That was in the initiative, and it would be very hard to change that. I do think that one thing, and I do disagree with Paul on the referendum. I went through that 30 years ago, and it did in the end work out. The Republicans did get better lines than the legislature initially gave them. There is a risk there, but I think the Republicans look at the Senate and look at the fact that for sure the Democrats get 2/3 handed to them. I think also they feel that if the court did draw the lines, they would not play the games that were played along the central coast. So I think that they can see that there would be some reason for something better to occur.
Well, to be continued, no doubt. That's Tony Quinn, co-editor of the California Target book. He worked for many years in Republican politics and government. And Paul Mitchell, Democratic political consultant, head of the firm Redistricting Partners. We've been talking about the redrawn political maps in California that were finalized yesterday for state legislative districts and the California congressional delegation. Paul, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thank you
very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, another take on redistricting in Sacramento. Yesterday, you heard from City Councilman Kevin McCarty. This morning, you'll hear from Ari Graswich, special assistant to the mayor. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Yesterday, I talked with Sacramento Councilman Kevin McCarty about how the city was unable to open many of its public swimming pools this summer. A listener called Larry tweeted me afterwards to say, "Wish you would have asked Kevin M. why their reasoning to close pools wasn't used in the city manager's salary talks." That's a reference to the city's recent hiring of John Shirey. His total compensation is tens of thousands of dollars more than his predecessors. Also yesterday, we played an interview with Spring Warren, the Davis woman who ripped out her lawn and used the land to provide about 3/4 of her family's food for a year. She's written a book called A Quarter Acre Farm. Later, a listener called Philip posted this on the Insight Facebook wall. "Wow, what a fun interview. Besides some gardening humor, I especially liked and related your comment about cutting your spinach. I feel the same about even pruning my trees and roses." Well, if you didn't hear the interview, Philip is referring to a comment I made to Spring Warren about how I felt strangely guilty when harvesting spinach I had grown. Well, back to today. Earlier this morning, we talked about statewide redistricting. Now let's talk more about the redistricting turf war in Sacramento, where the city council is still in charge of drawing its own political maps, albeit with the input of a citizens' advisory committee. Yesterday, I talked about that turf war with Councilman Kevin McCarty, specifically the tussle over an area traditionally considered part of Oak Park, an ethnically diverse, lower-income neighborhood, but also nowadays known as Med Center, after the hospital complex nearby. After yesterday's show, we heard from the special assistant to Mayor Kevin Johnson, who has a different position on the matter. We invited Ari Graswich to join us today. Bob, welcome back to Insight.
It is a pleasure to be back, and you're making me hungry with all that talk about spinach, Jeffrey.
Yes. What does the mayor think about this Oak Park / Med Center turf war? Where does he think it belongs?
He is not happy about it at all. As I've mentioned to several folks, I have not seen the mayor this upset about an issue for several reasons. Number one, it amounts to a stripping of assets out of Oak Park. And as anybody who knows anything about Sacramento, Oak Park is not a community that can afford to have its assets stripped away. And this essentially is doing that. It's taking three of the real generators in Oak Park, a Sacramento High School. There's a gentrified neighborhood right behind Sacramento High School, about 1,000 people living there, and the UCD Med Center. It's taking those three prime assets and stripping them away from Oak Park and putting them over in District 6. And of course, the mayor is not happy about that. Also, it was done without any public input. It was done 5 minutes before a council meeting, and that's when we found out about it.
But in the grand scheme of things, what does it matter if X neighborhood is in X district?
You know, I think generally speaking, it matters very little frankly. However, in this case, this is the exception. You're talking about Oak Park. You're talking about a community that has been on its back for a number of years. It has had a number of challenges and finally has three things going for it. Sacramento High School, one of the best high schools in the city of Sacramento. Again, the gentrified neighborhood, you've got people with real pride and commitment to their community, which isn't always the case in some of our challenged neighborhoods. And, of course, UCDMC, a major economic driver. You're taking those three top assets and you're moving them out. And what are you leaving Oak Park with?
We should note here that Sacramento High School is a charter school, which became a charter under the watch of Mayor Johnson before he was mayor as part of his St. Hope organization. Is that part of the issue for him?
Oh, absolutely. It's where he grew up. You know, Oak Park is his home. He was raised there. He's a third-generation Sacramentan. He went to Sacramento High School. When Sacramento High School was in danger of being taken over by the state, Mayor Johnson, then Kevin Johnson, just Citizen Johnson, stepped up and formed his charter program and really turned that school around. So it's personal with him, as it should be with a lot of us. I mean, I think there's a fundamental problem when you have a challenged community and you have assets being stripped out of that, when you have someone just coming in and taking the good inventory and leaving the scraps. I mean, I think that's a fundamental problem.
Yesterday on our show, Councilman McCarty said that the people who live in that area have called it Med Center for many years now and sort of suggested that perhaps they don't see themselves as part of Oak Park.
Well, with all due respect to the councilman, that's just not true. This title of Med Center was cooked up by a real estate agent about 15 years ago to try and sell some of those homes in the neighborhood
to doctors and nurses,
correct. It's the city had nothing to do with that. Also, you know, it's interesting that there has always been, going back to the 1800s, there's been a connection between the Med Center and Oak Park. The Med Center was built in 1871 as the county hospital. Oak Park was its first neighbor coming along in 1887. They've been linked ever since, and in every council map that's been drawn since 71, when they started drawing maps, 1971, they've been in the same council district. So all of a sudden, history is being forgotten.
How would the mayor have changed the redistricting process if he could? Does he think that it rightly belongs to the city council with some input from a citizens advisory committee, as happened, or would he favor something more along the lines of what happened statewide, where you actually have a citizens commission that makes the decisions?
Yeah, I think he would like to see the latter. He would be very happy to have a citizens commission make the decisions. However, what he wanted to see this time around was what you first suggested, was a citizens advisory committee giving us the jumping off point, because that's what the city council decided. That's what they discussed, and that's what they voted on, and that's not what happened.
But they got that jumping off point.
No, they didn't. What happened was, in reality, if you look at the maps, what happened was the four maps that the citizens committee came up with were thrown out. They were thrown out as two council members began pulling out their own maps, which were drawn in the dead of night and in secrecy. And that's a problem.
But I know that several of the council members, including Councilman McCarty, would argue that the DNA, shall we say, of those advisory committee maps have made their way into the maps that are now being discussed by the city council, that it's still drawn from that work.
Well, and again, that's just not the case. You can look at DNA, and it's the city boundaries. We'll give you that. I mean, it's still Sacramento. But when you look at the key elements of those citizen maps, they were radically changed by these members. And they were changed for the very reason that you and Tony have been talking about here for the last half hour. They were changed to protect bases of politicians. They were changed to protect politicians' seats. In other words, they were changed to allow politicians to select their voters as opposed to having voters select their politicians.
The mayor has been on the short end of some votes on a few matters, including redistricting. How do you think it's going to turn out when the city council finally approves the redistricting map?
Well, we are fighting the good fight. I hope the city council will come to its senses. You know, this is a power play, frankly, by one council member. There is no rationale or reason for this.
You're referring to
Council Member McCarty. And I'm afraid that we don't want to allow that one corner of a community to destroy the integrity of an entire process here. You know, the citizens are having enough problem believing in the process to begin with. So I'm hoping that the council will come to its senses, see the light, and do what's right for the city of Sacramento.
Do you mean that if the Med Center / Oak Park issue could be resolved, the mayor would sign off on otherwise what is being talked about, which, as I understand, carves the rail yards out of downtown.
Yeah, I think the mayor would. I think again he understands that in redistricting you have winners and losers. You have controversy. It's part and parcel of the process. And I think as long as there's an honest, open discussion about these lines, as long as there's public input, and as long as there's time for the public to weigh in and consider the positives and the negatives regarding these lines, I think the mayor would be fine with that. He doesn't want lines drawn in secrecy, and that's what you've got now.
And if I might ask you one question on another topic, it's just a few weeks away when the group that the mayor convened to come up with a plan to fund a new arena is expected to come up with its latest version of its ideas. How is that process going? Are they any closer to coming up with a funding scheme?
Well, I'm not at liberty to say. You know, as a matter of fact, they're making progress. I can tell you that. Unfortunately, the last couple of weeks, I have been pulled away to focus on some of this council business, some of this redistricting. But I know from secondhand that the mayor's Think Big Commission, that's the 70 folks, the mayor's big on bringing in members of the public. Those 70 members of the public and those experts are making progress. Their target date is Labor Day or a couple of days after Labor Day to present their financing, to resolve a lot of these financing questions. Not all of them, but a lot of them, and to set us on the track for March. As you know, March of 2012 is the deadline that the city has been given by the NBA and by the Maloofs to demonstrate that we have a viable plan for a new arena. Absent that, of course, the Kings will be headed south.
And when you were a columnist at the Sacramento Bee, you were critical of the Maloofs. Are you satisfied that they are adequately involved in this process for figuring out how to fund a new arena?
I think so. And one of the key changes from that day, the day when I was bashing them, which I did on a regular basis.
Public Radio.
You would have to bring that up. that was my brother, actually. No, the difference was they were owner, operator, and tenant in those days. And so as owner, operator, and tenant, I just wanted to see what they were going to contribute. In the new plan, currently, they're going to be the tenants, which means they're going to pay rent. And so it makes it a much more simplified formula to get them on board and to have them pay the appropriate rent versus having to deal with them as owners, operators, and tenants. They're just going to be tenants, which is, I think, a benefit to all of us.
Ari Graswitz, Special Assistant to Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, is the cost of redevelopment worth it in Sacramento? What will happen in Natomas if a new arena is built downtown? Those topics and more in our weekly local news segment with the Sacramento Press. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Is each Tuesday we talk about local news and lifestyle with the editor of the Sacramento Press. He joins us again today, David Watts Barton. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, we've been talking a lot about redistricting today and even a little bit yesterday, and that is topic A right now. So what do you have on redistricting in Sacramento?
Well, we've been talking about this a lot down at Sacramento Press, and just with everybody I talk to, it's really a mess. And Bob touched on the Oak Park aspect, which is really appalling. I mean, it's really kind of amazing that they've done that. But just the whole process and the way these maps suddenly appeared out of the void that seemed to basically just address the concerns of council members and not really but anybody else.
But Tony Quinn, of course, did say that when he was in the legislature, it was very clear from lawmakers that that was number one priority. So maybe we shouldn't be totally surprised.
Yeah, I don't think anybody. I mean, we had a story on it, and people were saying, even people who are part of the redistricting committee were saying, you know, we didn't really think that this was necessarily going to go through and that the council was going to pick anything other than what served their own political purposes. But it's still disappointing. And I think that overall, I think the council's reputation, which has already been pretty bad, has really taken a really bad hit with this one.
The final vote in the new map happens in a couple of weeks' time, August 30th. My guest is David Watts Barton of the Sacramento Press. Also of some controversy in Sacramento News, the hiring of the new city manager. Turns out he got paid quite a bit more than his predecessors.
Yeah, it's still within the range of what they're allowed to pay, but it's definitely on the top end. And it's also one of the things that people don't notice. It's actually a pay cut for him. coming as executive director from the California Redevelopment Association. On the other hand, he may not have a job very long if he's stuck with that one. So it's probably a good move for him. We hope it's a good move for us. We have had so many city managers in this town over the last few years. I can't remember where it's four in the last 5 years or five in the last 6 years or... And we've had temporary ones, and it's just been quite a mess as well.
John Shari's total compensation, including benefits, is going to be just over $300,000. And before that was announced, one of the city council members was quoted in the Bee saying that he would get paid more than his predecessors, but not much. But as my understanding is, it's about a 16% raise. And the context for this, of course, is a lot of services cut, a lot of people laid off, people having to contribute to pensions that weren't before, all sorts of things like that. 16% raise seems like quite a bit to me in the current environment.
Yeah, that's I'd be happy with one. it's, you know, I mean, there weren't that many people to choose from. We've talked about some numbers have been thrown around in the office that the Sacramento had about 30 people apply for the job. Davis was looking for a city manager and got about 70 people applying for the job. So, you know, and that may be a function of working with this council, which is their main job. It may also be a function of just working in a town that's a very hard hit town, and there are a lot of problems, and you're not going to be able to do a lot of fun things. You're basically going to be spending the next 3 years, which is what his contract is for, just trying to keep things together.
Now, redevelopment is also a pressing issue for cities across California, including Sacramento, because cities have basically been told by the state that you need to pay money to help basically help the state government out if they want to keep the redevelopment agencies going. What did Sacramento do?
Yeah, I mean, the whole redevelopment thing, the way the money bounces back and forth and up and down the governmental ladder is incredibly confusing. It was sort of good news, bad news last week. The city council did vote unanimously to pay the state the money that they would... that they would be getting in order to keep this redevelopment money coming. And I couldn't explain to you the mechanism on that one right now. It's very
complicated.
It's very complicated. But then the state Supreme Court, the next day, I believe, voted to stay that change for a while so they can let this run through the courts. And then, of course, John Shirey, the new city manager, is going to be involved in that lawsuit. So he's going to be sort of splitting his attention between running Sacramento and also being in court on behalf of redevelopment agencies.
And Sacramento has a lot of redevelopment projects going on, so they have a lot vested in this.
Yeah, there are a lot of them, although they're very controversial. And we've had people posting on the site saying, you know, this has cost the city up to, this has put the city about $1 billion in debt in terms of a lot of the projects that are already sort of in the pipe works, in the pipe. We have the La Valentina project, which is an affordable housing project right there on 12th Street downtown, which is really going to hopefully help put some more eyes on the street there in what is a very problematic neighborhood in Alkali Flat. And there are other projects that get some money from redevelopment, everywhere from R Street, K Street Mall, all kinds of places. Township 9, which is out in the Richards Boulevard area, that gets redevelopment funds. A lot of it is to help create affordable housing for people, which is not real. It's not super cheap housing. It's just housing for people who make a little bit above minimum wage.
My guest is David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. He joins us each Tuesday. Now, with all the talk about trying to build a new arena in Sacramento, probably in the rail yards, it's easy to forget that there is currently an arena, and it's in Natomas. And if there were a new arena, there's a big question mark over what would happen with all that land and property in Natomas.
Yeah, Natomas, people forget how big Natomas is. It's about a quarter of the city, it's north and south. It's a very big area. And Arco Arena has, for better or worse, been pretty much the center of that entire area of town. There are a lot of businesses that have sprung up around it. It's a lot of land. And what they're going to actually do with that land then remains to be seen. It's incredibly well located. I mean, it's right off of the freeway. There's a lot of housing around it. There's a lot of access. So, you know, they're talking about things like children's hospital. There is no hospital in that entire part of town. Which, you know, if you're looking for a hospital and you're in trouble, that probably, you know, plays into your. That makes a difference, right? So they've talked about that. They've talked about high-tech centers, different things like business parks. There are a lot of big businesses out there in Natomas now, but they're going to have a lot of land to use, and we'll see how that goes. And this was just a beginning thing where they went out and they talked to people in the community.
This was Councilwoman Angelique Ashby and Assemblyman Richard Pan.
Right, and they were mostly sort of holding a public meeting to get people's input on that.
The a building that most people have seen but aren't very clear about. There's some news on that. It's the Powerhouse Science Center. Been getting a lot of press. What's up with that?
Yeah, this is one of the things that is actually moving forward. We've had a lot of things that have stalled in the last couple of years, but this Powerhouse Science Center is going to open. It's going to have a planetarium. It's that old building when you're driving into town and you sort of see CalSTRS building over on West Sacramento, the new big skyscraper over there. On this side, right by Jaboom Street, right before you get into the town, there's this old, I don't know what era it is. I think it's a 1920s era powerhouse. That was PG&E, and it's just a big empty space. We actually had somebody went inside and posted some video of it.
Oh, yeah?
It's beautiful, yeah.
I'd love to go in there.
Yeah, it's really, because you can't go in. And we had somebody go in and shoot some video and post it on the site. It was very, very cool. But it's going to be, I mean, when that is done, it's going to be a real nice boon. It's also very close to Old Sac. It's, you know, sort of in our little sort of tourist area down there. So I think it could potentially draw a lot of visitors. And they just got a check for $7 million. So they're definitely on their way to building that.
And that could be in 2013. Well, a lot of people will be curious to see that. A little further south is the desire to better connect downtown Sacramento with Old Sacramento, I-5 being in the way. This has been talked about for many years. Yeah. Nothing ever happened.
Yeah. I want to know the name of the person who put the freeway there in the first place. We need a statue of him down there in between Sacramento and Old Sac. But they've talked about going over the freeway because there's the boat section, which is sunk down. And then they talked about just building a park over that. But because of changes in the economy and because of redevelopment money and all these things, they're going to have to back that off a little bit. But they still want to create more connectors over I-5 so that you can get from one side to the other. I mean, as it is, you can go from the Crocker. There's a bridge that goes right over I-5 over to the riverfront there. And there's a last year they redid an old train viaduct that's been turned into a pedestrian bike crossing. And so that's nice. I mean, that's gradually coming along. I mean, that's one thing that's actually being done as well. That's being built up over there. So, but the problem is still, of course, getting people through, you know, over that giant barrier. It's like the Berlin Wall going through the middle of Sacramento.
Yeah. We're just about out of time. Let's just pick one more item to mention here.
Oh, well, we're excited to report that the owner of Golden Bear is going to be opening another place. And Golden Bear, of course, has been featured on the Food Channel's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Yeah.
As have several Sacramento places. And this one is going to be down in Old Hangar 17, which is at 17th and S Street. Great old Quonset hut that was redone into a restaurant. They never quite made it work. It was, I think it was internal business problems as much as anything. But it's a great space, and Golden Bear has a wonderful reputation. That's going to open sometime next March. They don't have a name yet, but that's going to be a real nice addition to downtown.
David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. He joins us each Tuesday to talk about local news and related matters. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the mayor of Los Angeles joins us. He's in town to talk to the Sacramento Press Club about his campaign to change Proposition 13. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, Mayor Kevin Johnson introduces a new head of his homelessness initiative, Sacramento Steps Forward. Ben Burton comes from Miami, where he ran a similar organization. That story and more coming up during All Things Considered here on Capital Public Radio. The mayor of Sacramento, of America's second largest city, is in town. Antonio Villaraigosa speaks today to the Sacramento Press Club. His focus will be on changes he thinks need to be made to Proposition 13, the groundbreaking tax measure that reshaped how local and state government in California work and are funded. And I've just been told that we will not have Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. This was a bit touch and go. We thought it was going to work out, but it's not. So we will move to Plan B, a good plan nevertheless. Some shows are fully identified with one person, like This American Life in Ira Glass or A Prairie Home Companion in Garrison Keillor. Well, that's how it was also with NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and its longtime host, Leanne Hansen, who stepped down earlier this year after more than 20 years in the job. Hansen's permanent replacement starts in a couple of weeks. It's reporter Audie Cornish. I asked Audie how the weekend changes when you host a national Sunday morning show.
Well, the weekend nights are a little bit more subdued, shall we say, than they were, than they used to be. I think on Saturday we do some pre-interviews, some things that we need to record because it's hard to get people going for Sunday morning sometimes, some newsmakers in particular. And then very early Sunday, you know, we kind of pull it all together. You know, some of the more highly produced music and arts pieces we pull together. And then we always have breaking news. I mean, we have a lot of news on Sunday. I mean, if you look over this past summer, even something as simple, for lack of a better word, as the debt negotiations on the debt ceiling, you know, that kind of news, it breaks on a Friday and people don't really have a chance to digest it. And it's really on Sunday when sometimes you can take a step back and say, what just happened here?
So what is the weekend for a weekend host then? Is your weekend effectively Monday, Tuesday or something like that?
Our schedule is Wednesday through Sunday, officially.
Yes.
Unofficially, you know, I think we're competing with the other shows at NPR, the other shows in the NPR system, like, you know, your show, for guests and ideas. And sometimes that means that on a Monday and a Tuesday, you know, I'm looking through books that I'm interested in doing for the show, or looking up music and listening to bands we might be interested in, and trying to put out feelers to talk to them and do some of that preliminary research. A lot of my reading I do that week. You know, we do at least two books a week. And I can't do that reading, you know, Thursday and Friday when the show is really doing a lot of its last minute interviewing and collecting breaking news reports from reporters. So one good thing about the Sunday show is you can take a step back. But I think people really need to think of it like a magazine. You know, people don't put out Time the Sunday night before it comes out on Monday or Newsweek. It's like throughout the week you're gathering the materials that that make your news magazine what it is.
My guest is NPR's Audie Cornish, who will be the official permanent host of Weekend Edition Sunday starting September 4th. As I understand, your husband is also a reporter, so he's used to working funny hours and days. But still, has he said to you, Audie, what happened to our Sunday mornings?
He has said that, actually. Yes, that's right. My husband is a reporter, and he covers Capitol Hill. Here's the thing. We already used to get up for the Sunday morning news talk shows. We already used to get up to two or three newspapers and a bunch of magazines. This kind of conversation is what I like to talk about. This kind of conversation I like to have. We love to get up and have brunch and meet with friends. And I really am looking at Weekend Edition kind of like a brunch, you know, where we're going to talk about what happened last week and, you know, what's going to happen next week. And I've been listening to this band and they're really cool. It's all the conversations I would normally have, but now I'm going to have it with, you know, 3 million people instead of just my poor husband.
Was this your idea to be the host of Weekend Edition Sunday, or did NPR say, hey, Audie, we'd like you to do this?
NPR over the last 2 years has actually been bringing on a lot of people and sort of tryouts to be host. I mean, I think you're hearing voices on air now that have been doing training for a while. You know, another example is Guy Raz for All Things Considered on the Weekends, which is really a fantastic show. He's built it into something really great the last 2 years. And he started, like me, doing a lot of substitute hosting, filling in for people on vacation. So I think NPR sort of opened the door to folks like us to spread our wings a little bit. And then it was kind of up to us to decide as if we were going to build the kind of background that would allow us to apply for these sorts of positions. So let's say it's 50-50. I wanted to do it, and I'm glad that, you know, out of all the applicants, and there were a lot of applicants for this job, as many jobs at NPR these days, that they thought it might be a good match.
Well, there are a lot more reporters than hosts at NPR. Does it get a little competitive or tense in the staff kitchen?
It's very competitive. But, you know, I used to work on Capitol Hill. I was on the campaign trail. That's competitive. You know, that's nasty. That's like, you know, that is not a friendly environment.
Sure.
You're sort of colleagues and comrades, but you are not necessarily always friends. And I have to say at NPR, the thing that... the reason why people want to work here and why it's so fantastic to work here is because we all believe in what we do. We care about each other. We share information with each other. It is a total team-oriented sport here. And nowhere else is that more true than on a show, especially a magazine show where you've got this host of producers. The show is not just reflective of the host. It's also reflective of all the producers who bring all kinds of ideas to it.
Well, no doubt. But for many people who listen to NPR on Sunday mornings, they associate Weekend Edition Sunday with Leanne Hansen, who hosted it for over 20 years. How do you approach taking over a show that has been so identified with one person? Did you make a point of listening to Leanne more than before or asking her? Or do you want to just stay away from that to make it yours?
Well, one thing I think is... you know, the advice that Leanne gave me is that when she took on the job, she took it on from Susan Stamberg. And I mean, talk about big shoes to fill. You know, even then, 25 years ago, Susan Stamberg was a big deal and is a big deal still in the building. And she said that Susan told her that people are going to call you up and write you and say, Leanne, you're no Susan Stamberg. And that she's supposed to say, you're right, I'm Leanne Hansen. And Leanne looked me in the eye and gave me the exact same advice. You know, she said, people are going to say, you're no Leanne. And she said, that's okay. They're right. You're you. And that's okay. And, you know, this is a very tiny sorority here in terms of hosts of the show. These jobs don't turn over too often. And that's what I'm taking with me. That's my guide is, you know, I'm a different person and the audience is going to grow with me the same way that they grew with Leanne all these years.
You've reported from Congress. You reported out of the South for NPR for years. Does any part of you expect to miss that part of the job, being out on the road a lot and reporting from the field? Because obviously there's a lot of studio work when you're the host.
Yes, yes. Well, first of all, I think that we will try and get out when we can with the show. I'm game to do that and have talked to the producers to say, you know, any opportunity, even if it means I'm working a little bit later, you know, half an extra day, whatever it is, it's worth it to me to leave the studio and talk with folks. Second of all, you're right. You know, on the one hand, I am going to miss it. On the other hand, I've lived out of a suitcase for a very long time. I've done a lot of coverage of disasters, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes. I've done a lot of coverage that's taken me politically to different parts of the country. And it's about time for me to put my luggage away and think a little bit and to just analyze and take all those big ideas that would always hit the cutting room floor. Because a lot of times as a reporter at NPR, you're cramming things into a 3 and a 4 minute story, which in broadcast news these days is a long time. But for NPR, we sort of feel like, oh, we're not doing this thing justice. It's only 3 minutes. It's only 4 minutes. And I think the weekend is an opportunity to kind of lay that conversation out, kind of spread it out on the kitchen table and talk a little bit more. And I'm excited to do that. You know, that's an easy trade-off for me.
That's NPR's Audie Cornish on September 2nd. That's Sunday. She takes over as a permanent new host of Weekend Edition Sunday. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Liz Cazares, the assistant producer of Insight, James Morrison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll see you tomorrow. geophagists.
Uh-huh.
And is that a nice word? At Insight, we have one goal.
I don't necessarily know if I'm proud of that.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's such a crazy question.
We won't hold that against you, will we?
From interesting people of every stripe.
I'm Sicilian, so I talk with my hands a lot, so it's hard. The radio isn't great for me.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.